And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio 1. Welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors. Of course, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Rick Roberts started playing guitar at the age of 15, hoping to impress the girls at the beach in Clearwater, Florida, where he was born and raised. At the age of 19, he left college and hitchhiked to California with the dream of making it in rock. He got his initial break about a year later, taking Graham Parsons' spot in the Flying Burrito Brothers, with whom he did two albums, and then went on to two critically acclaimed solo albums. Winter Rose is the third band he has put together following Firefall and the Roberts Meisner Band. In between, he spent time with Stephen Stills' band, Linda Ronstadt's band, and a 20th anniversary tribute to the Byrds. Roberts toured as a member of Stephen Stills and Linda Ronstadt's band and penned more than 60 compositions, which were recorded and performed by leading musical entertainers. Singer-songwriter Rick Roberts and guitarist Jock Bartley founded Firefall in the summer of 1974. Roberts had served as a spark for the Flying Burrito Brothers from 1970 to 72. After Graham Parsons left, he contributed several compositions to the repertoire, the best known being Colorado, before launching his own career as a solo artist. Bartley had started as a student of jazz guitar, great Johnny Smith, Colorado Springs resident. With a few band stints around the Denver Boulder area under his belt, Bartley took over the lead guitar post of Tommy Bolin in Zephyr in 1971. The following year, he switched over to Graham Parsons' band, the Fallen Angels, which also featured Emmylou Harris, and Annette Roberts, whose touring schedule with the Burritos often overlapped that. And, sorry, I lost my train of thought here. Mark Andes, the founding bassist of the bands Spirit and JoJo Gunn, also joined with Bartley and Roberts, who began an informal series of jam sessions at his home in Boulder. Roberts thought of a fourth participant he'd met in Washington, D.C., singer-songwriter Larry Burnett. At Chris Hillman's suggestion, they added drummer Michael Clark, an original member of the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers. The break came when Roberts, Bartley, and Andes toured as Hillman's backup band. Hillman fell ill during a date at the other end in New York, and the club owner accepted a proposal to bring Burnett and Clark into town. Firefall finished out the engagement, and Atlantic Records was sold on the band. By January 76, the group had completed recording a debut album with producer Jim Mason, who blended the group's acoustic guitars, mellow pop melodies, and vocal harmonies. A sixth member, David Muse, joined the ranks on keyboards, synthesizers, flute, tenor sax, and harmonica. Firefall reached platinum status, and the singles You Are the Woman, Living Ain't Livin', and Cinderella took together sold in excess of 1 million copies. Firefall notched more hits, Just Remember I Love You, and Strange Way, and two more best-selling albums in the late 1970s, Lunacy and Elin. The band's heady time culminated in an opening slot for Fleetwood Mac's Rumours Tour in 1977, including a hometown Folsom Stadium gig before 61,500 Coloradans. It is my great pleasure to welcome singer, songwriter, musician, and author Rick Roberts to the Ray Shasho Show. Hey, Rick.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, how are you doing?
I hope you didn't fall asleep during that intro.
Oh, no, not at all. No, this is the small inconsistencies. No, which one always does when it's being bio'd. But nonetheless, so you know, it's funny, but, you know, just in a note in passing about that show at Folsom, that was their all-time record for the most people at a concert there. But that pales next to a show we did with Fleetwood also. It was a festival thing in Austin, mm-hmm. Texas, and that included also the band and Steve Miller Band and Chicago and us and England Dan and John Ford Coley, and that had 125,000 people.
Wow.
Which they were, as far as you could see, side to side, and straight back, they went up and over a hill, and they were still going. They had big, huge monitors at the top of the hill, so the people who were out of sight range from the stage could still see the band on the monitors. And that was, I mean, they helicoptered us in and out, and it was an unusual thing. I mean, you know, you get used to large arena crowds and things, but that one was still kind of stupefying. You know?
Yeah, that's like a mini Woodstock.
Exactly. I mean,
yeah.
It was half the size or whatever.
Exactly. Hey, Rick, do you still live in Colorado?
I do. I live outside Boulder.
Okay.
We lived in Boulder, my wife and I, for 12 years. And
yep.
Then the place we were living, we had a landlady who was my wife's best friend, even though she was 40
right.
years older. Nonetheless, she went into assisted living, so we knew we were going to lose that place. So when we looked around Boulder, we discovered that Boulder had gone way beyond our price range and
yeah.
way beyond reality there, you know. And the surrounding communities were really nice and more reasonable for, like, human beings, you know. So.
Right, right. Yeah, Colorado's a beautiful state. My niece lives over there. And I've been to Colorado Springs and Denver many, many times. I love downtown Denver. It's so cool, you know, with the little trolley cars. I guess the trolley cars are still there, aren't they?
In oh, yeah, they're on the 16th Street Mall.
Yeah.
You know, all around you, right along the Front Range, you have a run of Fort Collins and then
right.
Denver and then Colorado Springs, all lined up just against the Rockies, and they kind of they're little chain of great communities, you know. So, and Colorado, I mean, I love it. You know, you can have pretty much anything you want here in terms of sort of a geography. You can be in the mountains, you can be in the plains or in the Front
right.
Range, all that stuff. So it's great.
Yeah, my niece lives in Fort Collins. Her husband, she's a nurse, and her husband's actually a cop. But he's a nice cop.
That's good. There are those. We have
yeah.
nice cops.
Yeah.
Ourselves.
You know, I didn't know you were born and raised in Clearwater. I mean, Clearwater is only about 45 minutes from me. I'm in the Sarasota-Bradenton area in Florida.
Right.
And, growing up in Clearwater must have been a lot of fun, huh?
Well, it was. Well, you know what? In fact, you mentioned David Muse in connection with Firefall. David also grew up he and I went to school together. Played in our very first band together at the age of 15.
Right.
I had just picked up guitar, so I was only singing in the band. And David wasn't yet playing keyboards or sax, on which he is wonderful. But he played bass in that band. And, in fact, he was called the Neutrons, N-E-W-T-R-O-N-S. And he played a bass that his mom had bought him. He told me he had a neck like a piano neck. And he knew so little about music because he wanted to do it, but he said he didn't know anything about chords on guitar, so he simply followed the guy on guitar and his bar chords and played the E string, lower string on the bass at the
right.
same fret where the other guy was playing. And if anyone played an open chord, he just didn't play because he didn't have any idea.
Wow.
So it wasn't a very good band, but, you know, but it got us started. So
lately you've been up to, I know you've become an author. You've written two books, Song Stories and Other Left-Handed Recollections, and I guess your most recent one was Lame Brain, My Journey Back to Real Life. So I guess that's what you've been doing over the last few years, and then off and on with your band. The story is incredible, and you know, I've heard about the accident you had, which was a very freak accident.
A stupid accident. Really stupid. I mean, get your feet tangled up in the throw rug and hitting your forehead and ending up unable to walk for a year and a half. You know, and I mean, when it happened, I was walking in the hall, and we put this throw rug over the carpet where the dogs had stained the carpet with chewing up a pen.
Right.
And I just caught my feet and stumbled and hit my forehead on the corner of our General Island. And it bled for about 5 minutes and stopped. And I've cracked my head open a half a dozen times in my life, and I thought nothing about it.
Yeah.
And about a week later, my wife and I are sitting in the living room, and she said, you know, that blood blister that got on your head, it just popped. And so I reached up and came over with blood on my fingers. I said, yeah, I better lay down and let gravity do its work. So it bled for about 3 hours. It wouldn't stop. And she finally got me to go to the emergency room. She pleading with me for the entire 3 hours. I was going, nah, it's nothing. So we went in, and they told me, okay, here's what it is. You have a subdural hematoma, basically a brain hemorrhage, and you're going to lose your ability to walk. I went, nah, this happened last week. I'm walking fine. And, you know, he said, nah, it's going to happen. I said, when? He said, well, I don't know exactly, but soon. I said, uh-huh. So I went home, and everything was fine for about a month. One morning, I got out of bed. My legs buckled, and I couldn't get up. And that stayed that way for a year and a half. And so it was very, very weird. But, I mean, you know, tripping over a rug and not walking for a year and a half, not sort of parallel cause and effect. You know? So whatever. But,
now,
if you
had gone to the hospital immediately to the emergency room, could you have saved some of that long-term care or...
No,
or it would have been,
it was,
no.
The deal was done as soon as my forehead and
really
made the acquaintance of the corner of the
my gosh.
But, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, in a weird way, it was really a valuable thing because, first of all, I never in my life have understood very well the concept of patience. And I learned patience in things because once I finally got around to, it took me a year to actually get into serious therapy because I kept thinking, nah, you know, it's going to pass. Because,
right.
First of all, it was only my legs and everything else was fine. And I could still, if I leaned against something, I could stand up. But you know, my legs just wouldn't support me on their own. And so my mental set was such that I could say, this will pass. You know, it's just, you know, temporary. And finally, when I accepted that, I went in, I started the therapy, and I wanted it all to happen right then. I wanted to get it. They had told me when I went to the hospital the very first time, and they told me what was going to happen. They said, it doesn't pass permanently. You have a 50% chance of being able to learn to walk again, but you're going to have to work really hard, and then, you know, maybe. And so once I started, I thought, nah, I can do this. But, you know, it didn't happen right away. It took a long time. And I really had to learn that you don't get it when you want it necessarily. You just have to keep on with what you're doing and just refuse to give up. But, you know, that was the thing that finally convinced me. I finally went, okay, I can go and really work at this, and maybe I'll be able to get better, or I can accept that I'm going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life. No, I didn't accept that. I would not. So, yeah, but it taught me patience, and it taught me what an easy ride I had had, no pun intended, but what an easy trip I'd had through my life, you know. I mean, being able to do what I wanted to do with music, like that. And that took patience, too, but I was too young to understand the correlation between it not happening right then, you know, whatever. But nonetheless, you know, I mean, it gave me a little bit of perspective. And also being able to regain these smart legs gave me a lot of perspective on how lucky and how blessed I've been.
Are you still going through rehab for your legs and everything?
No, I
done.
Went through, it was probably 3 years of solid, you know, like twice
yeah.
a week for the actual sessions, plus
right.
3 or 4 days a week in the gym, you know, the exercises I had gotten from the sessions and the therapist. And since, well, I guess about 2010, I've been fine walking, you know, I don't use a cane or anything, and I don't, you know, it's pretty much back to normal. The only remaining consequence of my accident is I hit the left side of my forehead, and the left side of your forehead is your brain, you know, controls the right side of your body, and vice versa. So, as far as guitar playing, for quite a while, for several years, I could not strum on my right side, my right hand, my strumming hand. I, you know, as I've been telling you, it was kind of an adversarial issue. My head would say, okay, do this. Why don't you talk to me, sucker? and sort of like, you know, there was just not a total connection there. And in the last year or so, I really got to work trying to read. It took me a while also to accept the fact that it was going to come back. I was going to have to relearn to play. And yeah. I can't play all of my own songs, because the rhythm structure is a little too complex for my hand to do. But it's getting better all the time. I'm relearning to play. My chording hand was always fine, my left hand, because that was the left hand. So, so as I said, that's the only lingering consequence. And I've taken now, just in the last month or so, I have started to play in-house concerts, which are a really wonderful thing because they're very intimate and they're informal. And it's as much I'm telling stories about my songs and my life and all that stuff, as well as playing. But it's a really nice thing. I'm enjoying the kind of things I'm doing. So it's nice.
Talk a little bit more about the in-house concerts. Are these in local clubs, or are you broadcasting from your house, or what?
I've made myself available to do them wherever, and the process just started, but I'm already getting offers from all over. It looks like if we go down into a cluster of them down in the Phoenix area, and a little D.C. area, and what in Oregon. And I'm doing some locally. I'm doing one, in fact, about 3 weeks from now or something, at a place called the Old Town Picking Park in Nevada.
Right.
Which is, the last person I went and saw there was Paul Stuckey, so it's nice. They have nice people playing them, you know, and I'm flattered to be able to be, you know, playing there. But they're a wonderful thing. A friend of mine that I spoke to told me, said, okay, pun intended, but house concerts are the new cottage industry. And I said, yeah, okay. But it's true, there are actually literally thousands of hosts, if you will, both in actual homes and in stores that they turn into a little venue for the event.
Right.
And people seem to really like it because they can go in and get very personally, you know, close to their favorite people and like that, and there's question and answer things at the end, and you know it's a unique kind of a venue, and I like it very much. I've had a great time with the ones I've done so far, and I'm looking forward to a bunch of them. And I urge any of your listeners out there who host those kinds of things to come be in touch with me, because I'm you know I really am relishing.
Well, I'll spread the word over here. I mean, you should be able to come back to Clearwater for sure.
Well, that's one place that we're investigating right now. My manager is actually handling the stuff once we get past just the initial thing. Because, you know, I told him, oh, yeah, I can do this, Jim, to the manager. And he said, okay, you have two choices. We can channel it all through me. Your other choice is you could have complete chaos in your life for a while and try to deal with it all yourself. I said, I think I'll pick door number A. So,
yeah, you don't want to do too much too fast.
No, no. That's always the hardest part of the whole deal. Because I was, as you mentioned, my two solo albums, I toured as a soloist for 2 years a lot.
Yeah.
And I had a manager and an agent and all that stuff. But whenever I'd get out and I'd play somewhere and someone would approach me and say, hey, I'd love to have you come play. I have a club in such and such. How much you charge? I hate that. I want to get, you know, it's really uncomfortable. So I'd rather let someone else have it, yes.
Yeah, a lot of artists are doing those house concerts now. And like you said, the audience loves the Q&A. They feel like they're, you know, because, you know, we all grew up with your music. And you know, it's very important. You know, sometimes artists don't realize how important their music is to the fans, I think, because it's almost like a religion. You know?
Well, you know what? I have two thoughts about that. I agree with you totally. The one thought is, you know, it took me a long time to realize that my songs actually do, they have an effect on people.
They do.
Because the thing is, I've always felt kind of like I was cheating in a certain way. People come around, they say, wow, the gift you've given to people. And I go, wait, no. You know, I mean, that's really nice, but truth of it is, when I wrote those songs, I was not looking to contribute some humanity or anything. I was writing those songs for myself. You know, I needed to get something out of me or whatever.
Right.
So the other thing is wonderful, but it's an unintended perk or you know, just a little fortunate accident or whatever you want to say. That's the one thing. The other thing is that it's so very nicely connected for artists of my era and house concerts and all that is that the baby seemed to me to be the first generation ever who have really hung on to their music in a way no one else has. I mean, my parents, to the day they died, the old Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and all that, but they didn't go out and buy the new records when they came out or go to their concerts whenever they were in town. If they were in Vegas, say they went to see some show, but they didn't go to the concerts around. Our generation, still, they just their music from their childhood is a part of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Absolutely. So it's a great thing. I mean, once again, timing is everything.
It is. You know, the other thing is music today is nowhere close to what it used to be, you know. And that's another reason we hang on to that music, you know, because we know it was good music.
You know, it's a strange thing. There still is. I mean, certainly the most popular stuff is now. I mean, back when I was in my heyday, so to speak, there was an unwritten rule that if you wrote a song, it needed to have more than two chords and more than one line of lyric. And that seems to have gone out the window with certain things that are still music, if you will. And rap, I have to think, is more of a tone poem, you know, for most of it, because it's more all associated with the rhythm of the words and the beat behind it, but there's very little music really involved in it. Nonetheless, you know, there is still good music out there. I have a few bands that I've stumbled across that are really wonderful. The thing is that with technology having come as far as it has, once again, back in the day, so to speak, the record companies had total control of everything, and that had its upside and its downside. The downside, of course, was that a lot of really worthy artists were shut out or overlooked or simply they didn't catch, their timing was wrong, if you will use that term again. But one way or another, they never ever saw the inside of a recording studio.
Exactly.
Now, with Pro Tools and all that kind of stuff, everybody and his brother can make a record. People who should never be singing outside their shower are making records. You know, so the thing is that, like it or not, there's this flood of stuff out there, and trying to find the good stuff is like literally trying to find a needle in a haystack.
It is.
You know, there's the volume of stuff. I mean, and with all the things like CD Baby and you know and Amazon and all the places that you can submit your album or your CD or whatever to, and they will put it in their catalog. CD Baby, as I understand it, you pay $35 and they put you in their catalog. As a result, they have thousands and thousands of people. So if you don't know what you're looking for, you ain't going to find it. So,
it's tough,
It's just, you know, that's the downside. So whatever. Now, the upside, once again, is that those people that were overlooked or ignored or denied before, now they can get their stuff out there, but it gets just you know. So.
Yeah, YouTube is a very good avenue. I've seen some really good musicians on YouTube. You know, nobody knows who they are, but they're you know well known on YouTube. You know.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I agree.
It's a good avenue. You know, another way is, you know, Al Kooper, the producer. Al Kooper,
I know, once a musician as well as a producer. Yeah. Yeah, well, I know who he is, certainly.
He's got a column out, New Music for Old People. And he you know, gets, because that's all he does all day now is listen to new music. And he gives out, you know, he lets everybody know what's happening today, some of the music that we would like that are out there. And it's a good column. It's on the Morton Report. Yeah, I've talked to him now.
I have to look into that. I was not aware of that. I seem to have heard something about the fact he's writing, but I did not know what about. The thing is, you know, that I know that what he is doing is not exactly the same thing, but a funny thing is there's this black hole that has somehow formed, you know, in radio, and that is that you have two kinds of radio stations in the pop area. You have the ones who are playing all the current music.
Right.
And you have your classic radio stations, which play the old stuff. But the funny thing is that those classic radio stations, they want the old artists, but they want their old stuff. And the new, the current stations want new music, but they want it by new artists. Therefore, when old artists have new music, they have very few places to go. You know, now, there are a few. There's a thing called CAT, Classic Artist Today, which specializes in new music by established artists who now put out some stuff. And there's also a few independent stations. I know one in North Carolina called Magic 95.9. There, I say these because they are available on the net. They stream to everywhere, so everybody can hear. And they play new music by old artists. But otherwise, for all of us old guys who have some new music to put out, it's a rather.
Rick, I got to tell you, man, Firefall was such a great band, and I think in the long run they were probably underrated. They should have been a lot bigger. It was made up of pretty much a super group, you know, and your vocals made up the classic lineup. You know, if it wasn't for your vocals, you wouldn't have Firefall. You were a fantastic, you know, part of Firefall, and today, to this day, you know, your singing is incredible.
Well,
I really mean that.
Thank you. And, you know, it's funny because the band actually started as Rick Roberts of Firefall.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's credit is formed by Rick and Jock. Actually, I formed the band specifically. You know, I'd come off of two solo albums, and my second one did not do well at all in terms of stuff, and I knew I was going to get dropped. And when I had first gone to L.A., and I was auditioning around, I heard three answers a lot, just before they said, but not what we're looking for right now. And those three answers, one was, good singer, but the songs, or else, good songs, but the voice, or the one that comes to play here, you're a good singer, good songwriter, but you need a band. So when I got dropped, or knew I was going to be dropped, I figured I'll fool them this time. I'll have a band. So I put Firefall together to be my new backing. And that was what the whole scheme was. But when the label that was most interested in me decided they didn't want to do it, the band suddenly went, well, I guess there's no reason for us to stay together. I went, wait a minute, not so fast. Why don't we just drop the Rick Roberts and make it a band? And so that's what we did. And eventually, you know, we sent our tapes around, and still there are people going, yeah, it's really good. And what happened with what you mentioned about the Chris Hillman tour, Atlantic had already heard our tape, and they thought it was good, but it was, you know, there were so many artists at that point in time coming around with the material, and it was before Pro Tools, so you had to get to a record label, so it was going to the few labels who were. When we brought, I went to Paul Colby, the owner of the other end, and the Breeders had played there several times, and I said, Paul, you've got three hits of Firehawk here already. You've got Mark, the Indies, Jock Barkley, and myself here in the Chris Hillman band. So let me bring in Larry Burnett and Michael Clark, and we'll do it as Firefall, and you won't have a darkened club for the weekend. And he said, okay, sure. So that's how that happened. Our manager got in touch with Glenn and said, hey, they're going to be here. They're playing, so watch them see it. They came, and they said, okay, that's all. They can do it on stage live, because people were sending in tapes. It sounded great, but they had no idea we could be able to cover that same stuff on stage. And Firefall was an excellent live event. So that was the deal. As far as being funny, the first ad that Atlantic put out, they pulled a full-page ad in the Google magazine, and the headline was, "Don't call us a super group, call us Rifle." And we freak out. We called, "Why are you doing it? We are not a super group," because super groups are made up of artists who have been in hit bands for a grocery store with the Brothers, Hollies, all that. Okay, that's a super. But we were bands who had some, we had a track record, so to speak, Mark the Spirit, critically loved, but never a huge hit, one or two singles. You know, Michael, of course, had been in the Birds and the Burritos, and I'd been in the Burritos. The Burritos, once again, were highly acclaimed, but never much financial marketing success, you know, commercial success. And so we jumped in. On Atlantic's case, and they changed it. They kept the same picture, but instead of "Don't call us a they just "Don't call us a new Firefall." So, and it helped that a better word. Yeah. So, because, you know, super, it seemed kind of pretentious.
What made the band so great was the musicians were, you know, the proficient musicians you had in the band. I mean, you don't, like we were talking about, that we don't have that today. You know,
I agree. Well, you know, yeah. What? With Firefall, it's strange because we did. We had top flight players at every, yep, you know, every instrument. Now, you know, it's funny because Michael Clark over the years has gotten, he's got a lot of bad press in the,
right,
in the sense of saying, "Oh, Michael, he's not very, a very good drummer." Well, I say that's not right for two reasons. Number one, he is a... I only recently found out when I was doing my new band, Winter Rose, that because we were working with a drummer who's very good, but he'd never played anything but cover bands. Mm-hmm. And after 40 years, I suddenly woke up to the fact that I'd never had to work with somebody other than people like Michael Clark.
Right.
And I had Dewey Martin, the drummer, my band. And other people, all these guys I played with, they were used to playing original material. I had never realized that just like any other instrument, a drum has to create his part. I always thought of drums just keeping the beat, but it's not like that. You know, they have to know how to increase the. I mean, they have to put their part in to enhance what's happening all around them. And working with a drummer who'd never done any cover stuff, where the parts were already there, he just played what they played. And it took him a while to get used to the idea that, oh yeah, I have to make up stuff here. I have to come up with what's right for the song. So Michael, too, was excellent. But what I thought was really special about Firefall was the interaction that happened between David on sax and Jock on guitar. Because they played together beautifully. And it was a marriage made in heaven or wherever,
yeah,
you know. Yeah. And it gave my songs, you know, I mean, the band still are nice enough to come to me. They still play about 75% of their show because they are still there. Firefall is out there, David, yep, Mark, and Jock. And about 75% of the show are my songs. And they very seldom fail to come and say, "Rick, thank you for your music," and like that. But the thing is, what my music started off as and what it became after Firefall sat down as a group and everybody put their two cents worth in, arranging everything and like that, it's a whole step forward from what I find.
I think an interesting story too was the way you met Larry, who was a cab driver. You know, I'm originally from D.C. and
you know, I lived there for a while too.
Yeah, the cellar door, you know, is infamous. Of course, cellar door concerts. Every show at the Capitol Center were cellar door concerts.
Right.
And you met Larry at the cellar door, right?
Well, I'll tell you what. The manager of the cellar door, who is in fact now my own personal manager, Jim Geisler, he was Jack Boyle, who was Cellar Door Concerts. He was Jack's right-hand man.
Right.
And Jack, you know, not only the Capitol Center, Jack Boyle, he was before the corporations took over promotion nationwide, like Rhythm Nation and AEG Energy and all those big nationwide voters.
Do you mind if I cut in right now?
Sure.
Your guest's phone reception is not all that great. I'm not quite sure, because it sounds, I'll give you an idea kind of what it sounds like. Hi, huh?
Cutting in and out.
It's doing that, and it's breaking up. Is there a way that you can keep the phone a little bit more steady?
You know what? The phone is steady. I think it's my location of my house. See if it's getting better now. Because
that's good.
Yeah. Okay, I've moved to a better place in my house. I'm sorry about that. That's happened to me before. Okay, so...
Yep, sell it or...
To continue forward, the Britos and me as a soloist had played the Salvador numerous times.
Yep.
And so I knew Jim Geisler, the manager there. And I went back to do another solo gig in 1973. And he said, you know, Rick, I've got a friend, and I think you really should hear him. So I said, well, can you connect us? He said, yeah, he's driving a cab right now, so I'll set it up. So he said, next time you need a cab, you call me. So I did that, and he arranged for Larry to be the guy who picked me up.
That's funny.
So Larry picked me up, and we talked for a while as I was going to wherever I was going, and arranged for him to come over to the hotel later that day and play me a few songs. So he did that. And among those songs was Cinderella, which, of course, is an amazing piece of music, and several other knockout songs. And I told him, well, look, I'm thinking I might put a band together here in the near future. And Larry, being the pragmatic guy that he is, said, yeah, let me know when you get that together. So I went back to Colorado, and, you know, about a year later, the band was starting to coalesce. And I called Larry, and I said, Larry, I'm putting that band together. I just played the band. He gave me a cassette tape, and I played it for the rest of the guys, Mark and Jock. And we had a drummer named Brian Brown, who didn't work out. But nonetheless, I played it for them. They said, get him out of here. And I said, okay. So I called Larry, and I said, listen, come on out. And he was having some legal difficulty at the time and was in court for a drug thing. And he said, well, I'm going in for sentencing tomorrow, so if I get past this, I'll be on the next plane. So his lawyer, in fact, waved my arm to the judge, said he's been offered gainful employment, and most of all, Your Honor, it'll be out of jury. And the judge said, sentence suspended, and Larry was on the next plane. So it worked out for everyone in that context. And then with Brian Brown, as I said, you know, he was, in fact, too good technically, a drummer.
Right.
He wanted to treat drums like another solo instrument. And what we needed was someone as the foundation, someone to be. I call him a singer's drummer, like Ringo Starr is or Charlie Watts.
Mm-hmm.
They're singer's drummers. They don't try to do solos and things like that. And Michael is the same thing. And I had been with him in the Burritos. And in fact, Michael called me. He said about when Chris Hillman suggested, actually, Chris, he suggested Jim Mason, our producer, but he didn't have anything to do with Michael. Michael called me from Spokane, Washington. He had just come back from Hawaii for a year or two, and he said, hey, man, I'm back in the States, or back in the Continental States, and I'm looking for a gig. You know anybody who needs a drummer? I said, well, you know, Michael, as a matter of fact, I've got a new band I'm putting together. How soon could you be here? I said, when do you need me? I said, yeah, as soon as possible. He was there from Spokane to Boulder in about 48 hours. And we went directly into rehearsal, and that worked out very well. But, you know, nonetheless, so Larry came out, and at that point we had the five-man band, and we were playing around. We submitted our tape. In fact, we completed the negotiations. And while we completed the negotiations, I had been asked to go out for summer to tour with Stephen Stills. And I was the last guy to sign the contract. But while I was out there with Stephen, I had talked to David Muse down in Florida, because to my mind, the band, we had lead rhythm bass, drums, and you know, and that was, you know, what was happening. Actually, we had three guitars and bass. There were five of us. And so I figured we needed something. What I told David was we needed a utility infielder, someone to provide whatever color the song might need. And I understand you're playing sax and flute very well and keyboards. He said, yeah. And I said, well, you know, let me talk to Dan. So that kind of got spaced out when I left to go out with Stephen. David took it upon himself to come out and didn't say anything to the band about his connection with me or anything, but he jammed with him a few times. The band called me and said, hey, Rick, we met this guy. He's tremendous on sax and flute and like that. And his name is David Muse. And we're thinking he might be a good addition to the band. I said, yeah, I think that'd be okay. I said, actually, I know David. He said, really? I said, yeah. I was the last one. When I came back from the tour, I signed the contract in the first week of September, and then we got it a few shortly after that. So that's pretty much the creation of Firefall.
Yeah, David was from Bradenton, right, originally?
No, David was actually from Dunedin.
Oh, Dunedin, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I went to the Clearwater School System until my family moved midway
right.
through junior year, and I finished up at Dunedin High School as well with David.
Oh, you did? Yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, we long-time pals.
I want to tell my listening audience, the band's biggest hit single was You Are the Woman. It peaked at number 9 on Billboard's charts in 76. Other Firefall hits, Just Remember I Love You, which was number 11. Strange Way, which was my favorite. That was number 11 in 78. Cinderella, another huge hit, number 34 in 77. Headed for a Fall was in 1980. That reached number 35. And Staying With It was number 37 in 81. I love the intro to Cinderella. That is one of the best intros I've ever heard.
I think so too. By the way, you didn't mention Love That Got Away, which charted 42 or something, and So Long, which hit 30s somewhere. And you know what?
Well, that's
Cinderella.
Why you're here.
Cinderella would have been a much bigger hit. But, you know, I'm sure, Ray, about how records were on the charts. They would go up, they would rise to their peak, then they would linger there for a while, then they would fade all the way. Well, Cinderella was jetting up the charts. It hit 34, and the next week it was gone. It was off the charts. And we were, what? That's not the way that works, you know, because Michael and Mark and I had been involved in too many chart chases before that and hadn't seen things, you know, where they were. And we went into Atlantic. We said, what is the deal? What happened? I mean, it was there, and then it was just gone.
Yeah,
and
that's strange.
They said, well, here's what happened. And I don't know if you remember the scene in Miracle on 34th Street where the judge says something, and they bring in the loads of mail and dump it on the thing.
Right.
Well, that's kind of what Atlantic did. They had Ahmet Ertegun picked a phone and said, bring that stuff in. And they brought in this big old bag of mail and dumped it out. And it was all these letters from irate women saying, I'm never going to buy another Atlantic product in my life. If you're going to put out sexist, misogynistic things like that, that's trash. I mean, it insults all women and all this. Because the thing is talking, the song talks about a guy who got a girl pregnant and then left.
Right.
But if the people had taken to listen all the way through, the last verse of the song is about the guy saying, boy, I really screwed this up. I've made a terrible mistake. He's regretting what a jerk he was and how he did things all wrong. So, and in fact, just not to get too far afield, but Jim Geisler, my manager, he's an investor, a small-time investor in the remake of Fiddler on the Roof. So he went to the Tony Awards this year. And after the thing at one of the parties afterwards, he got into a conversation with Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm. And Barbara Streisand said, well, you're investing in that. What else do you do? Yeah. And he said, well, you know, I worked for a while with a band called, he had his own record label for a while, and all the stuff. He said, and I worked with a band called Firefall. And Barbara Streisand said, Firefall. Oh, yeah. They were a very good bit. But that song, Cinderella, and Jim explained to her about what I just said about the last verse of everything, and she said, well, you know, I admit, I just listened that far into the song. I got there, and I got offended, and I turned it off, but I'll have to go back and listen to it again. So Jim called me and told me that. I said, so that's what Streisand said? okay. You know, and I called Larry and told him. He said, really, Barcelona? That, you know, all cool. But anyway, so Cinderella, that was a kind of a freak of nature the way it happened. And also, and some stations took it out of the rotation because it had the words goddamn in it, which in the 70s was still,
isn't
the censors. Excuse me?
Isn't that silly that they took that?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, but that's not what most were offended by the song. Yeah. So it's a strange thing. And by the way, other thing I do want to say, we did have a number one record, and that was Just Remember I Love You reached number one on the adult contemporary chart. So I always like to throw that in because,
awesome. Great. You and me have a mutual friend, Joe Lalla, who passed away, what is it, a few years ago now, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, was Joe on, was he on the original recording of Strange Way? Was that him in the background?
Absolutely. And I don't know which verse you heard of it, but because they, on the single they took out, there's a jam at the end of it. It's funny because what happened with that in the studio, Tom Dowd was producing, and he came out in the studio, and we'd done six or eight takes of it, and Michael kept speeding up on the drums, and Michael is renowned for trying to beat you to the end of the song, or was, but, he had brilliant moments, too, but nonetheless, Tom Dowd came out and he said to Michael, listen, Michael, if you can keep this tempo down during the song, at the end of the song, we'll go into a solo or a jam thing, and you can take off. So that's really what happened, and the song stayed steady through the track, and then it goes out, and then it jumps up noticeably in tempo. And in the original recording, and in the original record, you can actually hear Joe in the background when they speed up. They're da 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 da, and Joe comes into the first thing, says whack whack whack. I can't even say it quite as fast. Whack whack whack. But we're all going, what? Those moments in the studio are kind of priceless. But nonetheless, Joe was on every one of the first five albums. Joe was the unofficial seventh member of the band.
Did you ever make him an official member of Firefall?
Never official, but he was there. Even when we went on American Bandstand, we had him fly out.
I saw him there. I did look that up, and Joe was there. Yep.
Yeah, and so Joe was definitely. And Joe was on my two solo albums as well. Mm-hmm. Joe's been an intrinsic part of my recording career throughout the years.
Yeah,
and
he's
a
such
dear
a good
friend,
guy. Yeah.
Great guy. I mean, I love the fact that after all his success, and he could have written his own ticket. He played with everyone from the Bee Gees to Crosby, Stills, Nash, you name it. But the thing is, two things happened. First of all, his hands were really, he messed them up just by playing conga so much and all that stuff. But he was able to get back to it, but he had to take about a 5-year break. He became an actor, and his acting career was starting to take off.
Yep.
But Joe sacrificed all that to come back to Tampa to take care of his mom.
Yes, he did.
And to me, I mean, those people, that's going above beyond. That's a great thing, and I admire and respect that as much as possible. And truth be told, his mom was not an easy thing to do, because she was an old Italian mother, and she was, I mean, you probably know this, I'm probably preaching in the choir here, but, and Joe used to, how do you do it, Joe? Okay. What is it? So he was doing, it wasn't like a walk in the park, necessarily.
Yeah.
But Joe was, a good, loyal, loving son, and did that, and great thing.
He wanted me to be his personal assistant and take care of it. He was having trouble keeping up with his daily finances and everything, and I had a banking background. So I couldn't do it because I was in Bradenton. He was in Tampa. But I did find Frank that took over that duty for him, and he was very, very happy with him. And he was friends of his family, by the way, and he was Italian as well. And a lot of people, Joe was Sicilian, but his roots, you know, in Ybor City, he was, you know, you couldn't tell if he was Cuban or not. That's how
I know. I know.
You know.
Well, you know what? Last thing, I'm very, very happy to say that I did get to play with Joe one last time. Not
about
one individual day, but one last arrangement. And that is David Muse put together a thing in about 2000, and what are still the last decade, last whatever century. But nonetheless, about 2012 or 13, called Boulder County Conspiracy, even though I was
the only one who's still living
in Boulder County. But that had Mark, part-time Mark Andes, Jock Barney, full-time, me, full-time, David, full-time, Bobby Caldwell from Johnny Winters,
Rick
Derringer, and Captain Beyond.
Great lineup.
And all that. And Joe. And Paul Codd was in there at the very beginning for Pogo, but he ducked out. There were two other guitar players. And two Florida guys, Max Boyd, I believe his name is, I hate to do this because Billy Shamlin was the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And another bass player named Alan Turner, I believe, who switched off with Mark because Mark couldn't do it all the time. But nonetheless, we played several games. We played in Wisconsin. We played one in Clearwater, in fact. And Joe was in there. And the whole thing, it was meant to be a sort of a montage of everyone bringing the material from their former bands. Because David went on to play with Marshall Tucker. And Joe had played with everybody. And everyone would bring their catalog, so to speak, to the table. And then just pick and choose from that. And Joe was doing an incredible Stephen Stills impression on Love the Way You Whiff. And one or two things from Blue's Image, because that was his first band out of Tampa, in fact. And
What happened to that band? I was really excited when that kind of formed. And I was getting, I think that I knew the guy that was kind of managing it or whatever, because he was also a writer. But he was wanting press for the band, and I said, yeah, of course I'll do it. But then the whole idea kind of disappeared after a while.
Well, the thing was that we spread all over the place. David and Bobby, of course, was in Orlando. David and Billy Sandlin and Max were in Clearwater area. Jock and I were in Colorado. Mark was in Texas. And the financial aspect of it just was impossible. You couldn't bring all those people together, fly them from all over. And the thing is, the band, it was an 8-piece band, and to the overhead for that many guys, you know, when there were guys out there, the way it was put to us, there were guys out there who had their own reputation under their own name. For instance, like Gary Wright, who did Dreamweaver. Gary was out there playing for a couple $1,000s a night, and it required like $8,000 to $10,000 a night to get everybody in from everywhere, pay their air freight to their hotels and all that, and walk away with even $10 a piece or something, you know, and nobody was going to do it for that. But so it just it collapsed under its own weight, so to speak.
Yeah, I could understand that. Yeah, everybody from all walks of all different places in the United States, and costly, like you said.
The thing is, a band, once a band is on a roll, and once they're playing around and everything, then you don't really need to get together much for rehearsal and things. But when a band is forming, it really takes a month or two of solid rehearsal, not just to learn the songs, but to get the chemistry going between the band, just like a football team or something. Those guys, they talk all the time about offensive lines and how, even though everybody knows their assignment and everything, for them to start coalescing and working as a unit, it takes a while longer. And the same thing is true with a band.
On January 2015, Firefall was inducted into the Colorado Music Hall of Fame alongside Poco, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and Stephen Stills of Manassas. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I would put you in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as well if it was up to me.
I don't know if that's ever going to happen because Jan Winter, we're not necessarily one of his favorite acts in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame seems to cleave pretty closely to what Yacht wants. You know?
Yeah, they do. I don't agree with a lot of their selections.
I'll tell you what. When I saw the, and I don't mean to call her out particularly, but when I saw that Patti Smith was being inducted, and Chicago wasn't in yet, I went, there's something slightly amiss.
Exactly.
I mean, because Patti Smith, I mean, an artist, fine, and everything like that. I personally had a couple of bad dealings with her.
You really?
Yeah, when I was a soloist, she opened for me at a club in New York.
Yeah.
And it was called the West End Cafe. It was close to Columbia University. And the manager's office was the dressing room. It was one of those small clubs. And so I was headlining and everything. Patti had just put out her first record. And her whole reputation was as a street poet in New York. And that's where Jan fell first, got an affection for her, and her material and all that. Anyway, the very first night after my first show, I walked back between sets to set night, and I went to go into the thing, and the door was locked, and I turned around to somebody to let me in, and, oh, no, Patti's in there, so I knocked, and she came to the door, and she and her girlfriend were having an argument. They said, you can't come in right now. We're busy. Get away. Find someplace. I went, excuse me. I just want to put my guitar up. Go find someplace. She was really rude and really.
Wow.
I went, And so I came away with negative impression. But nonetheless, that's neither here nor there. The thing is, she had one hit of a cover of Gloria from Shadows Tonight and stuff like that.
Which sucked anyway.
Yeah, but the thing is, I mean, the credentials for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame,
right.
Really? You know, and like I said, Chicago's not in there, and various other people who are quite
The Doobie Brothers aren't in there.
Yeah, I mean, come on. These are people who have had, and I think, well, I won't go into Jan's motivation, but it seems that he picks his own favorite acts. Like,
I love them.
Yeah, they're going in. And Steve Miller had a big beef about it. He caught a lot of flack for that, for sounding off about how imbalanced the whole thing was.
Right.
And they said, well, he didn't say anything until it was in, like that. Well, you have to think about the fact that that's when his voice had some, when he could speak about it, knowledgeably, And it's the same thing. It's like, I mean, missing the message because of the means used to do it. Like, all these people who are, I just read this morning, the governor of Nebraska, who's really giving a rational of stuff to some Nebraska football players who, elected to not stand for the anthem. Well, the thing is, everybody's objecting to that. Now, they're disrespecting to the. They shouldn't be doing it sporting event, that thing. Even if they say, well, yeah, they're doing it for racial justice, they shouldn't be doing it sporting event. That is those people's vehicle to have a noticed voice, for their statement to be noticed, If they don't do it there, it's not there. No one's going to hear a word about it, and they're trying to make a point. That's what protest is all about. As a child of the '60s, I remember protest. So whether I don't see how anybody could disagree that there is some racial imbalance happening. I don't see people getting. I don't understand people getting all caught up in. Well, this is not the venue for it. Well, it's their only venue. I mean, if I have an audience of 5,000 people up there, shouldn't I be saying whatever it is I want to make my statement about, rather than saying it, in my living room or what? I mean, use your vehicle, use your venue, There you have it. But Jan, so Steve got that ration too, for making a statement. But Jan seems to have been a little too personally involved, should we say. It's supposed to be the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, not Jan Wenner's Hall of Fame.
I agree with you 100%.
Rick, here's a question I ask everyone I've interviewed. It's, if you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie Field of Dreams, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Oh, boy. Well, let's see. I have a few favorites. A few of them I've come close to collaborating with.
Okay.
The people I most like to collaborate with don't need my help. So, I mean, for instance, I'll tell you what. One of my favorite moments. I went out to visit Jackson Browne one day to talk over a couple things that we were working around with. He was at the time, he was living with Joan Mitchell. And so it was at her house out in the Malibu Colony. So he and I were sitting there on the couch talking over whatever it was. I don't even remember. And Joan walks in to the beach door to her house. And she says, "Oh, good, two songwriters. I got someone over there by you." You know, and she sits down at her piano in her beach bikini and stuff, and sits down with sand on her, all over it and everything. And she plays that song, "You Turn Me On, I'm a Radio."
Oh, wow.
And which she did not get recorded or anything. And she said, "Okay, so I need to ask you guys, do you think this needs a bridge?" And I'm sitting there going, "I'm going to tell Joe Mitchell how to write a song? I don't think so." You know? And so I just said, "Well, Jackson pipes up, says, "Well, you know, Joan, you should have done that." You know, and I'm looking at Jackson like, "Jackson, even you shouldn't have to tell Joni Mitchell how to write a song. She does pretty good." You know, so,
yeah.
So if you'll notice, when the song was eventually released, she plays the whole piece, and in the middle, there's not a bridge. She asks us if we need a bridge. She says, "I'm going to tell you again one time if you still listen to me." And then she plays it again. That's the bridge. It kind of was a wash. You know, she did and she didn't. But nonetheless, if I could write a song with Joe Mitchell, that'd be great. All I'd have to do would be to say, "Okay, I think you should maybe put a pause there." You know, and that would be my contribution. Because other than that, there's nothing I could add to the situation.
How's she doing, by the way? How's Joni doing, by the way?
I don't speak with her these days. I've had some nice little exchanges with her and stuff. But, since I moved back from L.A. in 1991, I really don't correspond with hardly anyone out there except my old longtime peers and everything, you know. But I really couldn't say. Same with Linda. I know Linda Bronson has been going through terrible things with the Parkinson's and all, and I'd love to keep a little closer tabs on what's happening with that, you know, but I really don't have any way to do so. It's sad. We're reaching that age where, my grandfather used to go to the paper like so many others, and the first place he turned to was obituaries to see who he knew that had died that day. Well, unfortunately, we're now at that age where a lot of our peers are biting the dust.
It's kind of sad every time we lose another rock star, you know?
It really is. And, last year was a tough year.
Horrible.
I played poker with Glenn Frey at Don Henley in a game for 2 years, two nights a week. It was a steady poker game. And, although I had not been in touch with those guys recently either, you know, it was quite a shock because last I saw of Glenn, you know, he was doing the muscle builder ads or something, you know, for a while. And I was thinking he was a healthy guy, but
you never know, huh? Well, you know, Little Ron said did a wonderful, wonderful cover of your song, Colorado. I was listening to that the other day. And, I did a conference call. They set me up on a conference call. I didn't get to ask a question, unfortunately, but it was Linda Ronstadt, Dolly Parton, and Emmylou Harris. And this was about a month and a half ago. And Linda sounded great. She sounded wonderful. They were laughing and carrying on. You can tell Linda Dolly were really, really close.
That's great. That's neat. Yeah. I don't know Dolly Parton. I would love to. She's a remarkable personality. As famous and everything as she is, I don't think she's gotten credit for her ability as a composer. I mean, she's you know, I've heard Jane Fonda tell the story about how they were filming the movie 9 to 5,
right?
And they didn't have any music for yet. And one day Dolly walks in and says, "I think I got a title song for this." And she sits down and plays the song "Work at 9 to 5," and that's a very good piece of music, you know. And she's done a lot of good composing. Emily Boo, I haven't seen her recently. I don't know. One of my great one of the things I'm proudest of is that I kind of discovered everything, in the sense that, as I said, I used to live in D.C. too. Well, the Britos were playing at the Cellar Door at one point, and
right.
Chris Hillman and I were talking after the show about needing to do something to spark the band, to kick up a year. And Chris said, well, we could add a female singer. And we considered Linda. We said, what about Linda? Nah, she'd never do it. But when I talked to Linda later about it, Linda said, I'd done it in a heartbeat, because Linda was not the star that she became. She was not that big a star yet.
Right.
Anyway, so after Chris walked away, after we had this little conversation, a guy was standing there that I'd been acquainted with before I lived there. And he wanted to come and say hello, and he heard the whole conversation. And he said, are you serious about having a woman singer? And I said, well, something to think about. He said, then there's somebody you got to hear. And he sent me to a little club at the corner of P and 23rd, and a little box cutter of sorts, whatever. And I walked in, it was Emily Boo. And I said, wow, yeah, this woman is amazing. So I called Hillman, who'd gone back to the hotel, and that was at my own risk, because Chris did not like being served after he cut off the clock, so to speak. And he said, damn right, I'll come down. I'll come down and check your butt, you know. And so I sat on the far side of the room. Judicious move, I thought, on my part. Chris walked in, spotted me, started across the room with evil in his eyes. And by the time he got over to me, he wasn't even looking at me. He was looking back at the stage of the second folk songs. Well, we asked her to sit in with us the next two nights at the Cellar Door, which she did. And then after that, our next show was at Davidson College in North Carolina, and Graham Parsons was due to come and sit in with us for sort of a reunion. And so we flew into an airport that was an hour away or something, and we all met up there, and as we were driving across, all we could talk about was this wonderful singer we'd heard.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We played the gig. Graham had a great time. I asked him to come with us to Baltimore, our next show. So we all went up there. From Baltimore, we went back to Los Angeles. Graham rented a car, drove down to D.C., listened to Emily Boo play, asked her to be in a band on the spot. So there's that. But I haven't seen her in many years either.
Yeah.
So although I did see her when she had Al Perkins from the Guidos working in her band as a pedal steel player and like that. So it's all a small world. And, you know, I'm sure those ladies were having a wonderful time with the conversation and all, because they're all really remarkable women.
Who didn't have the hots for Linda Ronstadt?
Yeah. Well, you know? Linda's funny because, and I'm, by the way, with her disease and all that and not being able to sing, I've heard a few, not speeches exactly, but some talks that she has had. She's handling with remarkable grace, and I know how frustrating it is to not be able to do. Because when I couldn't play, the world looked dark, you know. But for her not to be able to sing after her voice and her gift, it has to be a tough thing.
Yeah.
It's funny because when I played with her, that was the result, in fact, of her cutting my song. I played on that record. And she asked me, she said, hey, we're going on a tour. Would you come out with us? So I went out and did a tour with her, and it was great fun. The thing is, at the time, you know, being on tour with somebody, you get to know them a lot better than you do any other time. Because it's almost 24 hours a day you're together, you know, almost. Your sleep time and then the rest of it, you're very closely tied together. Anyway, she was just a flighty girl, just real giggly and all this stuff, and good fun, and she didn't seem stupid or anything, but she was just a fun-loving kind of thing.
Yep.
And then I didn't see her for a few years, and I saw her at the Palomino in L.A. after she had been involved with Jerry Brown, the governor.
Right.
And I walked in and said, Linda, how are you doing? And she went, well, Richard, well, so nice to see you. She was the ultimate lady. And I went, who are you and what have you done with a real Linda? But it was great to see you. But like I said, I think she's handling her current situation with a lot of grace.
Well, she's back to the real Linda again. On the phone, she sounded bubbly and just
that's good.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, I mentioned that poker game. She was a part-time participant in that. And that was the most remarkable experience ever because she would come over and she would do that thing where, now, does straight beat three of a kind? Or which is better, a straight or a full house? Like, she didn't know anything about poker. And she would proceed to kick tail every time. She would come in there and she'd walk away with a lot of money. And the rest of you go, what just happened? You know, what was that? You know, and I don't think of the six or seven times she was in the game, I don't think I ever saw her walk away without a healthy profit. It was pretty busy. Anyway.
Maybe she was really a shark. You never know.
I think that's what it was. I think she knew damn well what was better than what. You know, so I just kept waiting for her to go ahead.
Let's talk about your books again. They're both available on Amazon.com.
They are.
And they're an incredible story. You've written two books, Song Stories and Other Left-Handed Recollections. And I know there was a special song in that one, Dolphin's Lullaby, that was very special to you because a lot of people really identified with that.
Yeah, people telling me that they played it on their record player for their little child when they were in the cradle and stuff like that, put them to sleep by it. And then finally one guy, my favorite story was a guy who told me that he did that when his daughter was a baby. And recently at her wedding, she used that for the father-daughter dance.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
That was pretty cool. I'm really proud of the two books. The reviews on Amazon for Song Stories, there's 25 or 30 of them, and all but four are five-star, and those four are four-star. And for Lame Brain, every review has gotten, which is about 23 or 4, something like that, they're all five-star, every one of them. So I'm pleased with the response that they're getting. So.
Yeah, I'm going to buy both books, and I'll put my two cents in there as well.
Okay, I really appreciate that. With this house concert thing, I'm going out and telling people that it's one of the first things that I've done, you know, as a solo performer in many years, and explain to them why. And it's a good story, and it's the truth, too, but, you know, nonetheless. So I'm having fun with that, and it's good.
Are you going to be writing a third book?
Actually. There's a couple things happening. Number one, those two books were both actually culled from my whole memoir, which I got talked into writing a few years ago, and discovered when I sent it to a literary agent that it was too long. So we started thinking of what we could take out, and my publisher and I were talking, and I said, well, we could take out Part 5, Song Stories, you know, and she said, no, we can't take that up. Your fans are going to want to see that. So we're talking along. She says, wait a minute, we're going to take that up, but we're not going to dump it and make it its own book. And I said, okay. So then we did the same thing with Lame Brain. On both of them, we pulled them out, and then I enhanced them. I expanded upon what they were. But now she would like to put out the whole rest of the memoir, sans the Song Stories thing. The Lame Brain content is a big part of my life. It took like a 5-year chunk and things like that. So that'll be in there, but it's not the same text. It's, you know, it's the version that the wording and everything that's in the thing. And it'll be listed as reprinted. So there's that. And we're putting that out as a hardcover with a bunch of pictures from everything. And also, I have a fiction book that I have been working on and writing called Family Trees, and it looks the prospects are very good for that being made into a TV show. So I intend to continue writing. That's my new secondary career, and I think that in another 10 years, I probably won't be playing as much, so I want to have something to do with my time.
Fiction's got to be a lot of fun to write, huh?
It really is, you know, because, I mean, so many of any composer's songs are if not total fantasy, they are
right.
enhanced reality. They take something and they build a poetic image around it. The difference with writing prose fiction is that you don't even have to rhyme the words. So, I mean, right. really, what I mean to say by that is simply you just have total. You can put it any way you want to. You can paint your picture with words, you know, any way you want to, and you know you have no rhythmic or other strictures that you have in a song, you know. So it's just carte blanche. So you can do what you want.
Yeah.
And if you have,
I want to thank you so much, man, for accepting my invitation. First of all, to be on the show today,
it's been really fun, Ray. Appreciate
it. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. More importantly, man, for all the incredible music you've given us through the years, you know.
Well, thank you for listening. Yeah, it's been a great thing to do. I really like it, and I'm still writing songs. I'm really enjoying that too. You know, so now that I'm playing some again,
Are some of your songs that you're writing now, do you think they'll end up in with other artists?
Well, I don't know. I would like that. I haven't had the channels exactly to get them to other artists, and you know that's getting to be a very difficult situation. In that, first of all, publishers don't do what they used to do. They used to go out and pitch your songs, everything.
Right.
Now a publisher basically sits there and collects the royalties, does the books and all that stuff.
Yeah,
you know, they're more of a bookkeeper than they are a pitch
right.
band. Nashville still works with pitch band, but even there, it's really a matter of timing more than any other thing. You have to be right there on the spot, and you have to know the right people to get them to. In pop and rock music, 90% at least of the artists are writing their own stuff, for better or for worse.
Right.
Or else their producer is picking it up for them. So, you know, I haven't had the channels at my disposal. But I'm hoping, once again, I bemoan the idea of Pro Tools making it possible for everyone to make a record. But I have some stuff with the new band. We're doing a mix of old stuff and new stuff. Now, the band is kind of on hiatus right now because, we had to replace a couple people. And I'm doing these house concert things, and hopefully, I'll be able to present my name and make it more financially viable to take the band out there and do stuff. And, you know, hopefully get some more songs onto the radio, because the radio has been very good to me over the years. I'm very pleased with radio. You're the Woman, they say, has had 6 million-plus airplays worldwide. And Just Remember I Love You has had about 4 billion players worldwide. And, and Strange Way, about 2 million. So there's 12 million plays of just those three songs. And that has been my livelihood the last few years. So.
Yeah. Well, I was one of those guys. I was a top 40 DJ back in the late 70s, so I definitely played a lot of Firefall in the air.
Well, then, thank you. I will say thank you and pass that along.
I sure will.
So
we're looking for great things from you. Looking for great things from you, possibly another book in the way. You're going to do those house shows. Then probably back with the Rick Roberts and Winter Rose band in the future. So you got a lot of things going on. And I thank you again, Rick, for being on the show today, and please keep in touch, man.
Thank you, Ray. I will do that.
All right, Rick. Take care.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. You can purchase Rick Roberts' Song Stories and Other Left-Handed Recollections and Lame Brain by Journey Back to Real Life at Amazon.com. Visit Rick Roberts' official website, www.rickrobertsmusic.com. You can also visit Rick Roberts on Facebook, www.facebook.com/RickRoberts, SFT Harrison. Very special thanks today to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of a Neglected American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. You'll live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.